Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 21st, 2005. This session, Job, Standing in Dust and Ashes, presented by Michael Pellet in the Fireside Room. Disc number POM 2005-09. Let's listen in.
And we shall begin. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. This is our fourth session on the book of Job. And what we have been doing in the three sessions so far, and again it will continue in this session, is look at the way that Job is a foil to and asks us to think differently about who God is and how God works than the picture that we have of God in the Exodus, and particularly Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 through 12, which are the theme verses this year. So Job is like a foil to Moses. And the way in which God delivers Israel from the Egyptians and that understanding of God's deliverance and God's justice and God's mercy is called into question to say, perhaps that's not the way one should always think of how God works and who God is. And that part of the difficulty there is that perhaps the way that Israel has continued to understand God's covenant is that it has been reduced into a notion of a contract. And that our relationship with God is now seen totally in terms of our understandings of what counts as reasonable, what counts as just, what counts as merciful and compassionate. And so this understanding of Job comes along and shatters us in our complacency and asks us to rethink once again who God is and who we are and what faith might be in relationship to this God. And we have looked at some portions of Job that raise those questions. We started at the beginning where we find out, surprise of surprises, Satan is up in heaven with God because Satan is one of God's chief employees. Satan is in charge of Homeland Security, the CIA, and the FBI. And so Satan's job as chief spy and accuser and to make sure all is well is taken on by God in terms of saying, God says to Satan, well, what do you think of my servant Job? There couldn't be anyone better than Job because we are told that Job is blameless and upright, fears God and turns from evil. And Satan's response to God is, does Job fear God for nothing? And that's the theme question throughout the book that we try to answer. Does Job fear God for nothing? In other words, Satan's implication, accusation to God is, well, of course, as long as you bless Job, Job will be faithful to you. And as long as Job is faithful to you, you're going to bless him. So this is a sweet deal all around. Why would you expect anything different? But take away everything he has. Take away his health. And you're going to see a far different relationship. So that what I called there in the beginning, one of the key questions is faith simply in terms of cost-benefit analysis? And we do that in terms of ourselves, and even to ask a tougher and perhaps more nastier question, does God engage or want faith in terms of cost-benefit analysis for God? And so those are some of the questions that were raised and that we have tried to address previously. Now today and tomorrow we will be looking at the last chapters of Job, which are the chapters finally where God responds. That up Up until this time, Job has always said, oh, I want to talk to God. I want to talk to God. Where's God? God seems absent in all of my suffering. If only God were here. If only God would say something. So, okay, in chapter 38, God shows up and God says something. And so today, as you see on the very brief outline on the board, we're going to look at God's first address. This is Job. It starts in chapter 38, verse 1, and goes to chapter 40, verse 2. And then we'll look at Job's first response, which is a mere three verses, chapter 40, verses 3 to 5. And so we'll see now, finally, with God responding, what happens. But to tell you right away that by and large, we will understand God's response to be most disappointing. Because God gives no reasons in the response for Job's suffering. Of course, that's Job's basic question. Why am I suffering? And when God answers, God, it seems, does not answer that question. At least not directly. What God does do is to deny that what Job has said about God, that God has dark purposes, that God is indifferent, that God has no justice or compassion, is a misunderstanding on Job's part. And so God's first response here, first address to Job, is to get Job and thus us as well to rethink God's purposes, the understanding of such basic notions as justice, mercy, and compassion. In both the first and second address which God makes to Job, and again to us, there one could summarize it all in terms of three rhetorical questions. And I have those questions on the board. Those questions are, who are you, where were you, and are you able? Now, the purpose of those questions, and those are rhetorical questions, of course, but the purpose of those questions functions, I think, at two levels, as do most rhetorical questions. The first function of a rhetorical question is that it can serve as an assertion. So that, briefly paraphrase, God might say something like, who shut in the sea with doors? Now that's really an assertion because we all know what the answer to that question is, right? God shut in the sea with doors. But we're asking that rhetorically. That's the first thing, and it's an assertion. But the second reason for these rhetorical questions, it functions more in terms of irony. And again, the way irony works is you're saying something, but often you mean the opposite. So to say something like, well, it's another cloudy day at Holden, isn't it? Would be a statement of irony. God's address in these rhetorical questions to Job, I think, are usually statements of irony because they are going to, again, subvert the notions of justice and mercy, covenant, faith, even notions of God, which Job has. And so that, again, God, that most frustrating of all beings, in answering Job, answers Job's questions not to really give an answer, but basically to subvert everything Job has said so far throughout the book. So it's a real exercise, I think, in subversion. And we'll look at a few places there to see how that works. What does that mean, to push that a little harder in terms of where this takes us? This act, this address by God, this act of subversion means that all of our conventional wisdom, all of our typical religious understandings go out the door. And so, for example, if we are to think that suffering is a notion of God's punishment for wrongdoing and faithlessness, out the door that goes. Everything that Job's three friends had told him goes out the door. It's kind of the understand, and we'll see this in Job's first response, a little foreshadowing there. What the kind of notion that you should come to after you finish reading these two addresses is to say, basically, everything I ever learned is wrong. And here, probably even more shocking, everything I ever learned in confirmation class is wrong. Sorry, pastors. It really gets us to think through what is happening here and how we are going to understand that. Okay. A few more kind of beginning comments. Other ways of, or other issues that come up here in terms of what are we going to rethink. What are we going to have to grapple with in terms of primarily this question of who are you? We're going to come up with, we're going to have to rethink new understandings of creator, of creatureliness, and of creativity. Right, and again, obvious to see the relationship that's there between all three of those. But that's where God's address is going to push Job and push us to think, to rethink those notions of what do we mean by creature, by creatureliness, and by creativity. And one of the ways in which that's going to happen in terms of this first address by God is the questions that God addresses to Job and to us pushes us out there on the margins. We're going to consider in chapter 38 the very boundaries of creation. We're going to think about it in terms, my folksy little notion about that is, God says, all right, let's talk about the neighborhood, the hood. And is your neighborhood, Job, the same as mine? And indeed, when we look at both of these neighborhoods, can we, along with Mr. Rogers, sing, it's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, right? Or not? What's it like living in God's neighborhood? That's chapter 38 as we push those boundaries. Chapter 39 puts us on the margins and pushes those boundaries in terms of the creatures that God speaks about. As we'll see, all of the creatures except for one are wild animals. And again, the animals that are considered the most wild, if you will, whether they be the lion, the wild ox, the ostrich, and I'll talk a little bit about what these kinds of animals symbolize and signify, But again, that kind of understanding, taking us out there into the wild in order to stand, to understand the creator, creatureliness, and creativity. The other thing that is there is that in naming all of those creatures, again, of course, the human is not named as a creature. The human doesn't fit in the catalog of creatures, but in terms of God's purposes here, the human being is the addressee. In other words, we as humans, or we can here again think specifically about Job, Job is not overlooked as insignificant. It's not to say humanity is not part of creation, but humanity again has a special understanding here, in that humans are the ones that God addresses with questions concerning the rest of creation. And so again, we have to ask ourselves the question, why does God confront us with questions about creation? And what does that say about us as creatures and our creatureliness? So that's the overview here in terms of what we're going to try to do with this first address. Are there any questions or comments about that so far? Do you have at least a sense of where we're going to go here, or are you already lost? Following along here? Okay then, if you would turn to chapter 38, please, in the book of Job. And chapter 38, verse 1. And I'll read it from the New Revised Standard Version here, that translation. It says simply, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind." And again, a whirlwind within the Hebrew Scriptures is often one of the places from which God makes an appearance. It's a place of a theophany. God will appear, and we can see there are different places God appears to Elijah in a whirlwind and elsewhere. The whirlwind is the language of, or the symbol of storm. And so again, God is not coming to Job in a nice, calm, quiet place. Complacent thing. Perhaps you may want to contrast it to, if you would want to have God appear to you, would you rather have God appear to you in a whirlwind or a burning bush? Right. Both of them, to be sure, are unique phenomena, but at least the way I look at it, burning bushes that are not consumed seem to be a kind of gentler, kinder theophany, as opposed to a whirlwind with a whirling, rushing, stormy kind of thing that's there. More again, a kind of symbol of chaos that's there, and the creator appearing in a symbol of chaos already, right, kind of just does things to our mind, doesn't it? The creator in chaos. But that's how God appears. And then God's first question, no, right? It's the who question. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? And again, that word here that we have as counsel can be translated a number of different ways. Who is this that darkens counsel, or who darkens design, who darkens the plan, the scheme, the purpose? Right. In other words, who's this who's darkening up, clouding up, overshadowing my plans, my purposes, my designs without knowledge? And again, God is using this word darkens very purposefully, because earlier on in the book of Job, Job characterized God's purpose precisely as darkening. And we had that, think about our some of those of you who were here, some of the discussions to say, when we think about suffering and ask that question, if that indeed for no reason whatsoever we suffer, that certainly darkens our rationality, our thinking, our approach to things, because we don't know. And so, Job is saying, God, you have left me in darkness. I don't understand, right? We still have that metaphor, that cliche, if we don't understand something, right? That you've sat here for a whole hour and afterward you'll leave and you go, I'm still in the dark about the book of Job, right? So I've left you in darkness again. Right? That's what Job said God has done. And now, right, God's starting to subvert here. Who's this who's darkening my plans? Because again, if we want to think back to Genesis 1, the first thing God said when God created was, let there be light. And Job was saying, well, you know, God, if you're going to look at creation through my life, it seems to me the first thing you said was, let there be darkness. And now God is saying, don't put that darkness onto me. God calls into question Job's words, which claimed that God really only brings about darkness. And that, if you will, to be very cynical about it, the only reason God created light is so that we could see better just how dark it really is. Right. That's how Job understands his life. And so now God is saying basically to Job, why do you darken my light? Verse 3. God continues then with Job, gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me. All right. Again, and I think this is somewhat interesting in contrast to our theme text from Exodus 3. When Moses turns aside to the burning bush, the word from God is, take off your shoes. Here the word from God is, gird up your loins like a man. I think the interesting thing is that when God says to Moses, take off your shoes, take off your sandals, what does that symbolize? What does that mean? What kind of action is it? If you were at the burning bush and God would say to you, take off your sandals, how would you understand that command?
Reverence.
Reverence.
Sit down and stay a while.
Sit down and stay a while.
Well, you have to get down there to take off your shoes. And in this one, you're girding up, you're standing up.
Okay, so when you take, and to get down to take off your shoes would symbolize or characterize what kind of attitude?
Humbleness.
Humbleness, humility, and so on and so forth. What kind of attitude is characterized here if somebody says, gird up your loins?
It's like pull up your bootstraps.
Pull up, yeah, right.
Quit, you know, let's get moved. Right.
Yeah, instead of take off your shoes, pull them on. Get on with it. Certainly, it's the notion here that God is not asking Job to humble, to be humble, to prostrate himself, to be reverent, that somehow, again, it's that notion, Job has been questioning God all along, and the first impression you get might be God coming to Job and saying, all right, Job, you lousy little good-for-nothing, get down and grovel. But no, not even asking for that sense of humility or reverence, but actually asking Job to be fully, completely who he is as human, to present himself with all his vigor and vitality and the best he's really got, right? He says, all right, Job, go for it, huh? Right? We're ready now. Hitch up your pants, boy. Right? That's what he's saying. That's what we're doing here. We're ready. You can see there that whole sense. And then that, I will question you and you shall declare to me. Declare to me, again, literally would be understood as make me to know. So it's that sense, okay, Job, straighten me out here. Make me to know what's happening. In other words, God's claim is that the way in which Job will answer these questions, the way in which Job will respond to God's address, to God's calling, will disclose to Job and to us who and what we are. So again, to look at this, gird up your loins, make me to know, are to be understood as the calling, will lead us to some kind of understanding of who we are and what that's all about. All right. So from there, as we look now at these chapters, and chapter 38, the things that are happening here. Again, to work our way into this. In chapter 30, verse 29, Job says that he has come to the limits of his existence, that he is, quote-unquote, a brother to jackals and a companion to ostriches. And what he means by that, to be a brother to jackals and a companion to ostriches, is that Job is out in the wilderness, in the wasteland, in the realm of absolute devastation, because that was the territory in which jackals and ostriches lived. So that Job, as he's there in his ash heap, standing in dust and ashes, standing in that devastation, that's Job's neighborhood. So we'll just put Job's neighborhood here as the land of devastation. And does Job like it in that neighborhood? No. No, he wants to move up or out or whatever. Chapter 38, now God gives us the neighborhood. And again, God, too, understands that neighborhood as one of wilderness, but it is not a land of devastation, but it's represented as a place of beauty. And so here again we see the contrast between the way in which God understands the neighborhood, and that neighborhood will even get larger than Job's in terms of devastation. And just to outline the broad parameters, here's from chapter 38 the poetic way in which the boundaries of God's neighborhood are described. Those boundaries include the foundations of the earth, the doors of the sea, the horizon of dawn, the recesses of the sea, the gates of death, the home from which light and darkness emerge, and the storage place of hail, snow, wind, and rain. So you can see it's a pretty big neighborhood. But it's also a neighborhood, again, where you see at those very edges and boundaries, it seems to be a way of desolation and a place of threat. But indeed, God will understand that to not be the case. And to just look at one example so we get a sense of how God is working here. If you would look, please, in Job chapter 38, verses 8 to 11. And if someone would read that for us, please. Anyone who would like to. Job 38, verses 8 to 11.
Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swallowing band, and described bounds for it and set bars and doors, and said, thus far shall you come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stopped.
Okay. So we have this image of God here again. We note these boundaries. He's talking specifically about the sea, and in the way he describes the sea, what image does one get of God? Here's where all your poetic skills come in. No, not quite a mother, but that's close.
A womb,
yeah, that's close too. But what do mothers and wombs need at birth time?
Crib.
No, not a crib. A midwife, right? Here's the metaphor. Here's the understanding we have of God. God is the midwife who helps birth what?
Earth.
The sea. Little cute baby sea. Now remember, most of the time within the Hebrew scriptures and within Middle Eastern religious thought and mythology, the sea usually is the symbol for what? Anybody know?
Chaos.
So there again, kind of look at the metaphorical clash that's going on there. Right? To say, what does God do? God is the midwife for sweet, cute, cuddly, lovable chaos. Now you can all put that together very easily, can't you? Right? Sweet, cute, lovable, cuddly chaos. See. And again, we've got the midwife helping to give birth, adds the swaddling bands or the swaddling clothes. And again, there, the imagery there, the swaddling bands, the practice is to wrap the arms and the legs of the infant because that helps calm them down. Right? Birth is traumatic, and so, you know, Luke 2, Jesus wraps the baby in swaddling cloths, helps to calm down. Typical birthing procedure. It's what you do to all cute, cuddly babies. And now, the sea, chaos itself, is that cute, cuddly baby that the Creator God midwives into existence. Right? So now, how do you think of the neighborhood? Right. Because this was, remember, Job, you thought this was land of devastation. This was land of chaos. And God says, oh yeah, my cute, cuddly baby chaos. Beautiful, right? Every baby is beautiful. Even chaos. Put that one together. Those are the kinds of issues. And throughout chapter 38, that becomes the understanding. All those boundaries that seem to be those of emptiness, chaos, devastation, meaninglessness, unknowability, God brings into existence and sees them as beautiful, caring, everything like that. So again, you see, Job's whole picture of this has to be radically redefined and reshaped. Same happens in chapter 39 with the animals. And again, we look at it as you go through there. Actually, we start with the animals at the end of chapter 38. It's chapter 38, verse 39, where it all starts. Where we have our list of animals. And the first one that's there is the lion, and it goes on. And as you read that and into chapter 39, you note that they're all going to be wild animals except the war horse. And it's hard to think of a war horse as the most domestic of all animals. And certainly the attributes of the war horse are not going to be its domesticity. But again, the sense is the wild animals. And again, the subversion that goes on here is first we're out in the wilderness. And in typical kind of biblical understanding, divine punishment would be such that a city or human habitations would be turned into wilderness, into waste, into a desert, into chaotic places, places that are hostile to human beings and culture. And it would be a place then that would also be occupied with eerie and scary animals. Here in chapters, I'll just say chapter 39, again, we see that the wilderness and these animals, this place of devastation and fear, is simply a place that God provides for and cares for these people. And these creatures. And so now the question becomes, what happens between our distinctions of cosmos and chaos, of culture and wildness, of places that are blessed and those which are God forsaken? We start out with the lion there in chapter 38, verse 39. And the lion symbolizes the predatory wild animal par excellence. And yet, it's God who hunts prey for the lion. Chapter 38, verse 39. Can you hunt the prey for the lion? The greatest predator needs a predator to help it get its prey. God, the predator, who cares for predators. Probably not the usual way we think of God, right? But there we go. On and on that goes in terms of those kinds of representation. All of these wild animals are all part of God's providential care. The wild ass and the wild ox, chapter 39, verses 5 through 12. We can have someone read those two sections, please, if you would. Anybody, to just chime in.
Chapter 39, verses 5 through 12. Who has let the wild ass go free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift ass to which I have given the steppe for its home, the salt land for its dwelling place? It scorns the tumult of the city. It does not hear the shouts of the driver. It ranges the mountains as its pasture, and it searches after every green thing. Is the wild ox willing to serve you? Will it spend the night at your crib? Can you tie it in the furrow with ropes, or will it harrow the valleys after you? Will you depend on it because its strength is great, and will you hand over your labor to it?
Thank you. Now, great agrarians that we all are, I think we can ask the question anyway. What do you know about donkeys? Stubborn. So they're probably not too easy to control, right? So if a donkey is stubborn, what do you think about a wild donkey, a wild ass? Absolutely uncontrollable. And of course, the wild ass, the wild ox, symbolize precisely that. They are those animals that evade all human purpose and control. They cannot be domesticated. That's the difficulty. And yet, of course, God loves them. God cares for them. God takes them in, indeed, as if they were domestics, puts them in the crib, fills their mangers with hay, so on and so forth, and they are taken care of. The contrast that comes in here is the play on words in terms of domesticate. That in the Hebrew, the word that means domesticate also means, and of course, teachers, we have to love this, to domesticate means to tame, means to teach. The function of teaching is to domesticate. So what do? With children who are 3, 4, 5 years old? We take those wild, uncontrollable, unruly creatures and turn them over to their domesticators. Pet them in the little classroom, put them all in nice little semicircular order, and domesticate them, right? That's the notion of what happens. And so therefore, again, of course, the wild ox and the wild ass are unteachable. I've had many of them in the classroom, right? No. But the notion here and what it gets us to talk about and think about is with regard to religion, is that its function? As we learn and know about God, is the function of religion to domesticate us? So when Job says to God, for example, teach me your ways, teach me what's going on, is Job saying, domesticate me? As that one little terrible camp song goes, I just want to be a sheep, ba, 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 ba.
Well, there's a difference to me between the word teach and educate.
All right.
And I would think that we need to be educated.
All right, and what happens to us when we're educated?
We learn, hopefully.
And what do we learn?
Well, hopefully that if it's a good educator, you learn to think for yourself and to make your own decisions.
Okay. And so you learn to be, in that sense, totally independent and carefree and pay absolutely no attention whatsoever to society's rules and mores and conventions?
Not necessarily.
Oh, well, then you're domesticated.
Okay.
Right?
Well, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, I have to think about that a long time before I could agree to so.
Well, that's great, yes. But I think, you know, the sense here, by and large, what teaching does, it's, if you wait, again, another way of saying, is this is how we acculturate people to our society, to our ways of thinking, to our patterns, and so on and so forth. So in other words, when you go to school, when you are taught, what are you going to be taught? Well, of course, you are going to be taught ways, to use the Jobin themes, ways of justice, ways of reason, ways of compassion. You're going to be taught the ways of God and who God is. And here again, God senses in all of this, you're always taught the wrong way. Yeah, you're domesticated, you're tamed, but you're really not taught any understanding of notions of this with respect to God. The sense here, what God is as the creator in terms of working with this notion of creativity, the creator God, the creaturely God who can work with the wild ass and ox and lion and ostrich and all of these others, is pushing us, if you will, to say that at least when we're talking about teaching and learning of God and God's ways, it has to be clean contrary to our normal ways of teaching. In other words, we're not again to be domesticated and tamed, but somehow the teaching of God, the teaching of religion, if you want to put it this way, pushes creativity, pushes freedom, and pushes that understanding of what we're trying to get at here in terms of faith is something which is untamable. It cannot be domesticated. It's wild. It's crazy. It's free. It's subversive. And if you think about that in terms of key biblical characters, they're a pain in the butt. Who would want to live with them? Right? Who would want to live with an Abraham and Sarah who think they are called by God that they'll leave everything behind and go somewhere else because God promises to give them a land and a place? And they say, okay, let's go. I mean, it's not quite that easy. But certainly they're not domesticated. Don't think that God calls us to tame us down. Or again, as we think about the way God works with prophets, one of the ways in which that a prophetic experience is described is that the prophet is seized by the Spirit. Not a particularly nice thing, is it, to be seized? That the roles there, the understanding there, are ways of, if you will, shaking us up. And again, we see that in terms of the craziness of the ostrich. Again, the name ostrich here literally means cries of joy. This ostrich is just this wild, happy, carefree, anarchic animal. running around in the wilderness.
It doesn't have the prettiest cry either.
Hmm?
It has a very ugly sound when it...
Well, that's the way you've been taught to think of it.
No, I've seen that.
God says cries of joy. God sees the ostrich here simply as the epitome of joy.
Where does it say in any of these questions that I can
that where does it say in the, any of these questions?
Well, who can do this? Who can do this? Who can do this? The implication, I guess, is God can.
Right.
He never claims it.
Right. Well, that goes back to our notion of how a rhetorical question works. When you ask the who can do this, the rhetorical question first applies the assertion, I'm the one who can do this.
Oh.
Right?
Well,
and then it also leaves us with this sense of irony. I think that's the two levels or the twofold way the rhetorical question works in this dialogue. So that your I can, that you know, who can do this? The answer to that is God can, and that's implied when asking that rhetorical question. Does that make some sense, or does that still seem
well,
too outlandish?
To me, a rhetorical question is virtually unanswerable, because the answer is, well, no one can. And a wild animal remains a wild animal. There aren't too many of them tamed by someone or something or God.
Yeah, but certainly the implications here in chapter 39, aren't they, is that God is the one who creates, who cares for, who provides for all of these wild animals that we might think are uncontrollable, untamable, yeah, and therefore worthless at best and threats at worst, and the implication here, the irony of all of this again, is God saying, well, you just have a really bad way of looking at things. Back to the story.
Then you have to ask, why didn't he just say it instead of asking these questions? I think the reason being is that Job has been saying all along, I want to question God. And so the question form is sort of needed as a turnaround, you know, rather than God,
yes,
just coming out and saying it, which would be a little bit more clear.
Perhaps, but to say, okay, why does God turn around and question? I mean, let's push that one a little harder. Is it just God's feeling a little ornery and saying, well, all right, Job, you asked some questions, now it's my turn. Who did this? Who did that? Can you do that? Oh, ha! Put you in your place, didn't I? Is that the purpose?
I mean, when my kids ask me questions that I know they know the answers of, I ask them to get them to think.
Okay, so
in some way, maybe God is asking Job to think about it.
So that God is asking Job to think about it more, so it's not just to put Job in his place. What else do you think? Why the question form? Anyone?
In verse 12.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have faith in that it will return?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that in asking these questions, it's also a way of trying to, again, I think here one might say, ironically, build faith. How would asking these questions build faith?
It can't be just another comforter. They had all the answers, and now God's going to give different answers. That's not what it's about.
All right. And how will that build faith?
Got to live in the Keats line, people who live in mystery, uncertainty, and doubt are faithful without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. And
all right.
Job has been reaching for facts and reasons all for 3 days here.
Okay. Put yourself in, again, teacher's position. Any of you have been teachers, and you should be, you know, you give an assignment. We'll keep it simple. You're a first grade teacher, and you're trying to teach someone how to add, and the student comes to you and says, I can't get it. How come these numbers work? How come when you say 1 + 1, it equals 2? I don't understand 2. How did you get that? I'll never be able to add. It's so hard. How do you learn to add? Why do we have numbers anyway? Teachers, how do you respond?
Ask your mother.
Having been a first grade teacher, I would give them one object here and one object here, tactile things that they can feel and put together.
All right. Would there be some questions that might go with it?
No, you keep doing that until it comes into their head.
I don't think so.
You use calendars and they just put them together and say, well, you have one here and one here now, and you get together.
Right.
Okay, on your fingers, you can put it together.
Now how many?
Yeah.
You did ask a question.
Here, how many are here?
But you do it over and over again, and all of a sudden they get an aha.
Times.
Huh?
They get an aha.
Yeah, but you keep asking that in terms of question. That basically, to keep putting it in terms of question is a term of encouragement. Right? Or, pick on you, Paul, as track coach. Somebody, oh, coach, I just can't run this. I'm too slow. I'll never get that. You know, and you go, well, okay, let's think about it. So, you know, how is your form? How is your position? How is your, right? I mean, you ask all these questions about various things to see, this is how you can work your way through, right? Questioning is a way of encouraging. Questioning is, one, a way in which we show our disillusionment. We ask questions, but it's also the way we overcome our disillusionment. We question our way right through it. And I think that's what God is doing here too. Asking the questions to help Job, to help us question our way through discouragement, disillusion, unfaith. And why might I say that? To kind of where we're going to end here. Chapter 40. We finish all of this. We have these things, and then Job's answer. And in verse 4, it says, see, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? Now, I want to propose a bit of a different translation there, because again, this is poetry, and I'm, you know, words can mean differently, if you will. The Hebrew word there that is translated see can also be translated if. Now, what happens if you read that sentence, if I am of small account because of all these questions, God, what shall I answer you? What happens if you read it that way? If I am of small account, what shall I answer you?
Is it kind of asking your question again back?
He's asking.
Making it sound very humble. Rather than a statement?
Yeah. He's asking it back. What, someone over here, I heard what...
It didn't sound as humble, if I am.
That's right. Job, again, and I think that's part of it again here. Job's response is not again, I'm going to be humble, I'm wrong, I'm terrified in your presence, I'm stupid. That's not it. What sense comes out of, if I am of small account, what shall I answer? It asks the question back. That might be one way of saying. So we keep questioning, we keep staying in the dialogue. What else might happen here? Where does this first discussion leave us, leave you, in terms, again, of this key question?
So he's asking God, am I of small account? I mean, do I even matter? I mean, you asked me this, but if...
All right. Anybody else? Where do you think it leaves you?
Job does not have his questions answered. He still wants his questions answered. Why am I the way I am? Why do I have boils on me? Why have I lost everything?
So in other words, God's first round of address to Job hasn't done anything. No growth whatsoever.
Well, is it possible that he's just asking God back another rhetorical question? Okay, well, you have all the answers, so you tell me, which he wasn't wanting to do before.
Okay. Anybody else?
Job's still leaving open the possibility that he is not of no small account, that he still matters.
So there's that sense to it too. What about any sense in growth and understanding? What about for you?
How much can I know? How much do I need to know? I certainly can't know what God knows.
Okay.
How much do I need to know?
All right. And what does that help you understand in terms of? I'm going to force you to that question. Who are you? Who are you, Vivian, now that we're there? If you ask the question, how much do I need to know, what does that say about who you are?
It all comes back to my faith. Oh. What I know has strengthened my faith.
All right, so who you are, what you need to know and all of that, it comes back to some sense of faith. And what do you now know about your faith from all of these questions, from God's first address?
Yes. God is an authority and will take care of you.
God is an authority and God will take care of you. Even if you're covered in sores from head to toe.
Yeah, eventually.
We certainly want to grow in the faith.
Grow.
However, right now, my faith sustains me.
Right. I don't know what we can know here. Job doesn't say anything. He just says, well, if I am of small account, what shall I answer you? And then he says, like, basically nothing. So I don't know, how can we know if he's grown? Unless maybe not saying anything signifies something.
But his non-response is really interesting in that it happens four times. Like, within this, you know, what, like, see, I am a small account, what should I answer you? Well, somebody who really wants to stop being in dialogue would stop after the question mark. And then he says, I lay my hand on my mouth. Again, another sign, he's not going to talk anymore. I have spoken once, and I will not answer. Again, it could end there. Twice, but we'll proceed no further. So even in his desire to stop talking is this impulse to continue talking, you know, that there's something that's unstoppable within him. Even in his desire to end that relationship, sort of.
Yeah, I mean, again, isn't it? I mean, you kind of picture this stuff, you know. I'm not going to talk anymore. Lay my hand on the. Well, do you want to talk? I mean, you know, the guy can't shut up, just like me. The bell rings, you keep talking, you keep talking. Now, there is something there about faith. What do you know? You're right, Dan, in terms of the thing. We'll find out at just a little foreshadowing at the end of the second dialogue. Job says, ah, now I know. But the terrifically frustrating thing is we're never told what Job knows. So we don't know if he knows anything. And yet at the same time, there's the claim that some answers, some insights have been given. And I think, and again, I
he's
think
he's just
it,
been fully domesticated. He's been beaten. Into submission. He's been beaten into submission by God by saying, "Listen, I did this. I did, or you know, who do you think did this? Who do you think did that? Blah blah blah." And what can I say?
Yeah. Well, that is certainly a very that is a very traditional answer to all of this, isn't it? Right. That what that when Job says, "Why is there evil in the world?" God bombards him with all those questions to say, who are you, worthless creature, human, to question me?
I'm sorry, I don't mean it.
Right? Beaten into submission, precisely. Domesticated. But, I mean, at least there, I want to propose a very different reading to say, no, I don't think that's the way the story should end. God does not beat Job into submission to just say, accept suffering. Why? Because I'm God. Any questions?
Why did this happen in the first place? Because Satan goaded him on to do it.
Well, you see, but there the tricky thing is we kind of decided that it was really God who goaded Satan. Oh, yeah. All right. We will leave you hanging here and try again tomorrow to see where we go. Think about it, though, in terms of who are you? What does faith have to do with all of this? Thank you very much.